Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here is your host, Sean Graham.
Thank Adam. Welcome to History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today, nearly live from Vancouver, British Columbia, where I'm getting ready to head back to Ottawa following a very successful Social Sciences and Humanities Congress and Canadian Historical Association annual meeting over in Victoria over the past few days. And today, we're going to do a bit of a recap of the Congress and talk a little bit about the purpose of conferences with three terrific guests. First up, we have Daniel Ross, the president of the Grad Student Committee of the CHA. He's from York University. Then Joe McCutcheon, who is now the treasurer of the CHA, also from the University of Ottawa, amongst a variety of other affiliations. And then finally, Jody Nurse, a Congress rookie. We get her perspective from the University of Guelph. So first up, my talk with Daniel Ross. All right, and with that, we will welcome in Daniel Ross from York University. Welcome.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for doing this. So this is your second time at Congress, you're saying, and you are the president of the Graduate Student Committee of the CHA. So in general, just in that capacity, what do you think the role of grad students is in a conference like this? Not just even the CHA, maybe Congress in general.
Well, this is something we were discussing in the meeting yesterday, and you were there, Sean. It's somewhat of a fuzzy role because grad students are, on the one hand, a block with sort of different interests than faculty, but at the same time, we're aspiring to be faculty. And I think the role of the Graduate Student Committee, at least, is to represent graduate students within the association, provide a voice for our own specific concerns, whether that's funding to get to CHA, publications, because you need those to get a job. And as for graduate students in general, I guess we're learning what it means to be a professional historian when we come here to the CHA.
Do you find it, or have you found it, intimidating at all?
No, not at all. I found everyone really friendly, really eager to meet me and ask me what my project was. No, nothing intimidating about the whole experience.
You know, I agree. The community tends to be very, very welcoming. And very excited about some of the stuff that grad students are doing. But although I could see how it could be intimidating for people because, you know, I mean, I'm just used to seeing names on books or on articles and stuff, and then to see them as real people, it's like, whoa, I mean, they're not. It's like when you're a kid and you see your teacher in the mall, and you're like, wait a minute, the teacher can't be at the mall. The teacher lives at the school. They're just school. Like, that's it. So it's interesting to sort of see people in a new light from just having read them. And it's a really interesting dynamic. So for you, in going to different panels and stuff, do you have any highlights so far, anything that's really stood out for you?
Yeah, one definite highlight was the panel on digital histories, which I saw yesterday. So this involved a couple different digital history projects, one out here on the West Coast, which was about Chinatown in Victoria, one which is about commodity trading. And this is a big data project that scans archives all over the world to look at where commodities are being talked about. Something you can't do, you know, with an individual historian's time or resources. And the third one was Ian Milligan, who's looking at how are we going to use the web as an archival source.
Right.
So this was really cool. I was somewhat familiar with the projects, but I think this is a direction we're all increasingly being forced to go to, especially if we study contemporary history, and that fascinated me.
Yeah, and nice shout-out to Ian Milligan, Active History. There you go.
Catering
to the people who are here.
And I'll say Jim Clifford, who also is an Active History guy, was involved in the in the Training Consequences Project.
Anything in particular that speaks to you in your work and what you do? Because, I mean, one of the benefits for me is coming into these things, and even if people aren't talking about broadcasting, maybe the way they frame their projects or the way they contextualize things, it's really interesting for me then to go and revisit my own work and take some of these broad concepts. So has there been anything like that for you?
Yeah, and actually, in that panel, there was a presentation by John Lutz and a team of people working on Victoria's Chinatown, and they actually tracked, using newspaper sources, sort of what they called an index of anxiety about the Chinese population in Victoria. And there are peaks. So you see on the graph they plotted, like 1860, 1880, people were talking more about the Chinese, and there were actually more negative mentions of the Chinese population. And for me, as an urban historian, I thought immediately, wow, I can use this to talk about Yonge Street, which is what I'm studying at the moment. Like, when were people worried about the sex trade on Yonge Street? When were people worried about what does this mean to have our downtown be slightly seedy? Is it in decline? I thought immediately that I can do this. And it's a good way to visualize one's work rather than just presenting it in a written format.
So one of the things we were just talking about, too, is you mentioned that the notion that here it's 2013, and you mentioned that, you know, Ian and Jim talking about digital things, and the digital world has really expanded, even in the last, say, 3 years. Like, I remember trying to stream TV shows when I first moved to Ottawa in 2009, and it was really tough, but now compared to now, it's really easy to just stream stuff, so you don't actually have to download them and use up all that space. So,
not that we engage in illegal activity like
no,
that.
No, I do it, absolutely, I do it legally through the websites of the networks who are airing the programs, and I dutifully sit through the commercials. But it leads me to this question of, I mean, I spent 7 hours in airports and planes on Sunday, and I'm spending 4 days on a train going back, which is something that I've always wanted to do, and this just gives me the opportunity to do it. But there's that time commitment, there's the financial commitment to come to something like this. Given that the digital world is expanding so much and things can be so accessible that way, and the fact that, you know, I'm conscious that in our regular work, reaching out to all Canadians is very difficult to do digitally, given that the internet coverage can be sporadic in different parts of the country. But something like this, most people are affiliated with a university or some sort of institution which would have internet access. So I'm wondering then, is there a point in which we transfer something like this to an exclusively online setting to save, frankly, the money and the time for everyone involved, but you still get that interaction academically? Granted, you would lose the social interaction. But I'm just wondering what you might think about something like
yeah,
that.
I'll say,
because you've also come from a long way.
I've come in from Toronto, and it's a long flight and a costly one. I'll say two things. So first, I think down the road we could share the load a bit and put some of this stuff online. I think blogs, webinars, like these are all good ways to disseminate our research. And as you mentioned earlier, when you get into a panel and you have three people reading their papers, it's not entirely different from actually reading their papers online or having them Skyped in, right?
Yeah, especially if they're monotone people.
Well,
yeah. And it's the end of the day.
Yeah.
I'll be honest about it. Like, yeah. There are certain presentations that you go see, and I honestly wonder, like, why would the person who's doing this go to all that trouble when, like, I can read? And it's one thing to read and be interesting and be alive and be engaging. It's a different to just read there and look at your paper and not look up at all. I mean, there's different levels of it. So
acting classes, communications classes would not be untoward for academics.
Faculty members lecture. Mm-hmm. And you hear reports of people who are great lecturers, and then you go see them in a conference, and they're not being great lecturers. And it strikes me as very confusing as to why aren't you being a great lecturer? Mm-hmm. Why would you change what's been so successful for you? I realize the audience is different, but the goal is the same, to impart the knowledge or to send this message. So why would you do something that is seemingly less effective?
And I agree. But getting back to your original question, yeah. I think one of the most valuable things about a conference like this are the social interactions. Mm. I'll give you an example. Last year at the CHA in Waterloo, I met a student from Montreal, just over a coffee in the little nutrition break or whatever they call it. And it turns out she's working on environmental activism, and this is something that I'm interested in. We get to talking just by chance, and then organize a panel for this year's CHA. Mm. And during that panel, I meet, you know, my four co-panelists who I've just corresponded with by email. We have a good conversation. I think things will come of that, too. So there's these sort of social contacts snowball.
Yeah.
For example, I've met you for the first time here in person. Wouldn't have been as much fun on the internet. I don't know if that's a reason to keep doing these things in person, but it's a reason to think before we move everything online.
No, yeah, for sure. There's definitely benefit of seeing people face to face and having conversations, and you know, it's just the issue then of travel is what it is. And I know the next 3 years are in what is interestingly called Central Canada, which I know at least next year is the St. Catharines, Ontario. So, you know, I mean, if you're in the West, you sort of kind of get hosed a little bit, but for you and me, that'll be okay.
So there is this because someone referred to this today. I can't remember where I was, but someone referred to when it's in a place like this as a regional conference, because there'd be such a larger concentration of people from the West and such a smaller concentration of people, especially from the East Coast, who would make this trip. So maybe there's a middle ground somewhere where you can have it, continue to move it around the country, and for places that are, or for people who can't attend for whatever reason, maybe there's a way to have them Skype in and do their presentation or something like that.
Yeah. And that I totally agree with, because that'll just add to the conference experience. And also things like, you know, we meet in person once a year, but we can keep digital contacts going all year.
Yeah.
And that can be through podcasts. That can be through discussing on active history. Mm-hmm. There's often a good comments section after articles.
Yeah.
So I'm totally in favor of that stuff. The conversation shouldn't end, you know, on June 6th when everybody leaves Victoria.
Right. All right. Terrific. Daniel, thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Sean. Appreciate it.
Daniel Ross, York University, the president of the Graduate Student Committee of the CHA. All right. And next up on our Congress recap, Joanne McCutcheon from the University of Ottawa. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Sean.
Well, the University of Ottawa and other places. I say the University of Ottawa because I'm from the University of Ottawa, too.
Perfect.
Selfishly like that. So we just talked to Daniel Ross a little bit about grad student experiences at Congress, and you have an interesting story about your first Congress because you weren't even a grad student yet.
No, I was an undergraduate student working for the summer at the Farm Women's Bureau in Agriculture Canada. And I knew about the Canadian Historical Association and the Learneds, as it was back then, and convinced my boss to send me and go to the Rural Studies Association and the Canadian Historical Association. So I went as an enthusiastic observer and had a senior professor take me under his wing, Don Davis from the University of Ottawa, who helped me stargaze and identified historians that I'd read and been studying as an undergrad, and was super excited to see them in person.
And little known fact, he's immortalized by the grad students at the University of Ottawa with the Don Davis Cup, where he donated his mug that says Don on it to the grad students, and that is awarded annually to the trivia winner.
Excellent.
It's still done. I'm sad to say that I was on the defending championship team this year, and we had lost, which was a very sad event. But nevertheless, that tradition continues. So you're one of the more prolific or active people online within the community, and particularly here at the Congress. Whenever, if you search the CHA hashtag, for Congress, a lot of your stuff comes up. So I'm just wondering, you know, how has this online presence, things like Twitter and Facebook, how has that changed the Congress experience?
I think that there's a couple of things going on there. In terms of social media, gives us an opportunity to find out what's happening in sessions that we can't attend. Mm-hmm. And so often I'll be looking for the hashtag to see what other people are saying about their sessions. And it's also great for folks who couldn't come.
Yeah.
And so I have people making comments that they're happy to be following along in the conversation because for whatever reason they're not able to attend this year. And so it's great that people can share in their community that sometimes has an overlap. And other times it's about reaching out to other disciplines who are here at Congress. And so I use the hashtag for Congress 2013 and also for the CHASHC 2013 so that I can follow multiple feeds.
Right. Is there a danger, though, in being so active online? This happens to me, and maybe it's just because I'm not attentive enough, that when I try to live tweet a session,
mm-hmm.
I almost lose some of that. Even though I'm in that room and I'm mm-hmm. tweeting about it, I sort of lose parts of it because I'm going back and forth between trying to write the tweet and mm-hmm. tweet it out and still listen. But at the same time, I want to make sure that what I'm tweeting is accurate to what the person is saying, because I don't want someone coming to me later and saying that you didn't get that right. This is mm-hmm. what I said. You've misrepresented it.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel as though personally, as the person in the audience, mm-hmm. when I try to do it,
yeah.
I think I lose some of the experience or some of the information that's coming.
Mm-hmm. So this is new to me. This is something that I've been working on the last year or so, trying to learn more about it. And I'm sure that there are ways that I can do things better. But in some ways, it helps me keep track of some of the conversations that are happening. And I also, you know, I keep my notepad handy. If there's something that comes up, that I want to take note of. And sometimes, you know what, I don't find that it's an appropriate venue to tweet. And so sometimes I'll just hold back and I'll take notes and try to judge the room, try to judge the audience. And you know, if I feel like it might not be something that is going to attract conversation, then I'll hold off. So far, I haven't had, you know, any negative feedback, and but would respect if somebody was like, no, please stop. And I always try to acknowledge the people who are in the room, and often we'll try to, you know, if it's Tina Liu, for example, you know, acknowledge that she's the one speaking, or if it's Ian Milligan, he's the one speaking, so that they see what I'm tweeting, and make sure that I hashtag them if they're not on Twitter, so that it's not something that gets forwarded to them as, look what this person was saying about you. And the American Historical Association's come out with some guidelines for live tweeting, and the Anthropological Association. So just try to keep up, make sure that, you know, use best practices, and try to model for other people who aren't sure about it yet, because it's new. And last year it was a little bit. This year I think it's a little bit more. But it is something that will grow over time, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's, maybe it's, because I was in a conference in Washington.
Yeah.
And I know Stuart Henderson was there too.
Yep.
And I tweeted usually after a session. I was like, hey, this is sort of a, my 140 character synopsis of what happened, which is a very unfair thing to do. But just being there and following that hashtag, that hashtag, now granted, it was a bigger conference as well, just more people. And that hashtag seemed more active than this one. So it seems like it's still a new thing for folks.
I would say
here,
for sure, that even just the number of historians in Canada who are on Twitter, there's not a lot. I wrote the bulletin article in the spring just about it. And I think there's, you know, it's fairly new for some people and they're not quite sure. National Council of Public History, they have fully embraced it. And it was, I mean, they were getting, I think one day they had 2,000 tweets from the conference. And, you know, they were doing breakdowns of the conversation, what kinds of keywords were going out. So they were really into sort of saying, you know, what was actually being broken down and analyzing it the next day. I don't think we're there yet. In part, we don't have
well, the constituency of a public historian.
That's
kind of part of your job now, is to be on Twitter.
Yeah, and some people would argue that, you know, some folks use it in the classroom. But again, I say that we're probably a little bit more conservative in embracing social media. But I kind of go back to, you know, last year's annual general meeting when Chad Gaffield came in and talked to us about digital history, digital humanities, you know, some of the changes. And I really took to heart some of his comments about, you know, embrace it, lead it. Otherwise, people are going to tell you how to do it.
Right.
And so I think that's something that's resonated with me the past year and a half is just, okay, how can I be part of this instead of after the fact trying to adapt to it?
Yeah, but because even one of the things, I was at the grad student business meeting yesterday, and there was people in there, we were talking about how do we get more grad students involved, and Emily suggested, what if we have a Twitter account? And a couple of people in the room were like, well, I don't want, like, I don't use Twitter, I don't want to use Twitter. Was their perspective, and I was surprised by that, that there was that resistance from people who are still grad students and young grads. They're not mature grad students. So I was surprised that there was that sort of pushback on that. And it wasn't that much of a pushback. It was just sort of, I mean, how am I going to have access to the information if I don't use it, was sort of the point of view. And it was interesting to me because it seems so pervasive now in that, you know, if you watch a sports broadcast, they'll tell you the players' handles when they come up the bat or when they score a goal or something. So,
well, you'll notice, like, one of the things that tomorrow's presentation we're presenting together, like, I make sure that my Twitter account is there so that people who do want to say something about what we're talking about can actually then mention. But that's not part of our culture yet. It's not part of, you know, we're not there yet. And so I think we'll catch up. And, you know, sometimes people have to experience and get it. And if you just go by folks who are going, you know, what do I tweet about? Or this is, you know, I don't care what color socks you wore today, whatever it is. There's those kinds of conversations for sure, but there are those kind of conversations on the bus. Or like if you just replace Twitter with conversation, and it's just a different form of having a conversation, and you can connect with people you know, all over the world. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting for me and great because there's lots of people that I have conversations with over Twitter. And now at the conference, I get to see them. And that happened at the National Council of Public History. Mm-hmm. It's happening here, you know, and it's happening when I go to, you know, the archives. I'm like, oh, I know you from, you know, yeah. Twitter, which before there might have been a different way in which we knew them. Mm-hmm. But now it's connecting us. Same thing with Facebook. We have several Facebook pages associated with committees. The Children and Youth History Group and the National Committee for Public History and a number. And, you know, people are having conversations or keeping up to date on what's going on, you know, more quickly. And sometimes we can do that while we're standing in line or we're waiting for a bus or, you know, where you can't really pull out a book and read, but it just fills some time and we're keeping connected. Maybe it's for people who are frenetic and always need to be busy, but maybe that's a bit my personality too.
Does it maybe detract then from the experience of being here?
It doesn't replace it. Absolutely. No. Okay. No. And it's like, you know, interviewing Cornelius Janin earlier this year to talk to him about his experience attending Congress. I mean, the number one component is networking, right? And there's nothing like networking in person, meeting a person, shaking their hand, sitting down, having a beer or coffee and talking to them about their research. Mm-hmm. So it's like you open up the door through Twitter and then you step inside and sit down when you get to the conference, right? So it just makes meeting somebody a little bit easier. You know, when you're not face-to-face, maybe you're a bit shy. Then when you get a chance to see them in person, there's a few barriers that are broken down at that point.
Hmm. Now, you are also a council member.
Yes.
On the Canadian Historical Association.
Yes.
Now the treasurer.
Yes.
As of, what, 2 hours ago?
Yes.
or whatever it was. So I'm just wondering, as a council member, how do you approach Congress differently from how I would approach it? And, you know, what is the council, or at least you as a councilor, what do you hope people get out of Congress?
Mm. Well, I think what I do more is listen to how people are feeling about the program, the sessions, logistics, and just sort of listen to what kind of feedback people are giving in terms of, you know, great conference, ways to improve, etc. And, you know, I may not have been able to share that directly, or I might have brought something that I heard to friends on council before, but now I'm sort of more conscious of it so that if there is something that we can do better or adapt to other people's needs, then I can maybe bring that back to Congress or to the executive and say, you know, maybe next year we need to do something a bit different. Mm. You know, I think, you know, the response around daycare, right, has been sort of,
yeah, it was really strong.
Yeah, it was brought to council and, you know, we unanimously agreed, you know, something has to be done. And, you know, I'm one of those people, right? I'm lucky I have somebody who's helping me. You know, if not, I may not have been able to go, or I would have been away from my, you know, child for a long time, and it would have been hard, as it was last year. So last year I didn't bring my daughter, and it was, you know, it was a long time to be apart. Yeah. And so just being able to have that option, I think, is important for graduate students, for faculty, for emerging scholars. And that's an example where people can interact and we go, yeah, and we can bring, you know, real evidence of people who are in that situation where it's a more difficult Congress to attend, more exhausting, all those kinds of things.
And the irony of that too is that for the most part it would be younger scholars who need daycare because they are more likely to have young families.
Absolutely.
And they're the ones who, you know, need this to really further their career.
It's really hard. Yeah, and so you throw gender in, and I mean most often, not always, but often it is, you know, young female scholars that have the most difficult time. Men are more participatory in parenting, and sometimes it's, you know, if you have an academic couple, then they have to make that decision, right? Who's going to go? Who's going to stay? Who's going to care for the children? And so maybe one person's career is put on hold for longer, and that can be a challenge too. So you just kind of hope that council and Congress is listening. And so those are the kinds of things that you can kind of go, yeah, definitely positive. Yeah. Response around it. So
The little orange stickers. Lots of people with them.
Yeah.
So I was told when I inquired, I asked about the first one I saw was on Monday.
Yes.
And I asked somebody, I said, "What is that?" And they said they didn't know. And then I kept seeing them, and then I figured I thought maybe it was something like you'd bought something to go on like this, the tour tomorrow night or something. Maybe that was your ticket.
Drink ticket.
Yeah. Or something like that. That's and then sort of I saw it more and more. I can't be that. And, so today about like 2 o'clock, I finally figured it out. But the response to that has been
absolutely
really strong. Yeah. What have you been hearing about Victoria as a location? Because I talked to Daniel about this a little bit too, and just the idea of having it on, and it's true of the other coast too. I don't want to pick on the West Coast, because but this is a beautiful city, and this campus is delightful.
Yes,
I love that they intentionally have what is essentially a big middle finger to the rest of the country by having a big fountain in the middle of campus. Like, thank you, University of Victoria. I need to know that you have that. But has there been, what has the response been to Victoria that next year, in the next few years, they're going back to Central Canada? So is there been any negative response to this in terms of that it's such a far distance for so many people to come to?
It's always a challenge, right, with a huge country. And so I think that you couple that with financial cutbacks, and you have to be more conscious of where you're holding your conferences. And it costs so much more for the Federation, for the CHA to hold it in other locations or more remote or smaller communities. And I think they'll just have to adapt to that for the next little while. But it's important too for, you know, folks to be able to go to the different regions. So I think that there will be a conference or Congress coming up. I can't remember what year, but it will be in Newfoundland.
Okay. I like that.
In several years, maybe 2016, but don't quote me on that. I'm not sure, but there will be one coming up in Newfoundland. And, but it may be a longer time between going further afield, so you can kind of build up a reserve, right? So that you, and people can plan and people can, you know, save money or whatever to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And just come up with different strategies to be able to go further away. Yeah. Because, you know, usually people have great times, you know, like I went to Newfoundland in 97 and it was fantastic. And, you know, Calgary, Edmonton, you know, all the different locations. And it's always an amazing experience to see a part of Canada that you don't get to see very often if you're not from there. But certainly it is more challenging. Mm-hmm. You know, not only our organizations, other organizations face it all the time, right? Yeah. And you just sort of plan, do the best and hope that, you know, James Ogg did a fantastic job of being able to secure funding, right, for graduate students. Yeah, so those are the kinds of things that, you know, we always know that the conference will be a little bit less attended, but not that much more, maybe 75, 100 people less.
And to be fair, I mean, when it's in Central Canada, if you have it in, it was in Waterloo last year, next year it's in St. Catharines. Mm-hmm. Those places aren't necessarily accessible if you have to fly in, because you still have to get from Toronto to wherever, and those places can be 2-3 hours away from Toronto, and flights into Waterloo and St. Catharines, I guess you could fly to Hamilton if you're if you're going to St. Catharines, but those flights aren't necessarily easy to get for people from the West or from the East, and so if you don't already have a car, so there's logistical problems really anywhere you go. And hell, even if you do it in Toronto at the University of Toronto, you still got to get from the airport into the city, which is a pain.
Absolutely. And folks last year, I remember, were driving early in the morning leaving Toronto to get to Waterloo.
I commuted from my parents' house,
So it's never perfect. But you know that it is a little easier to be able to carpool or take the bus or the train. Being on an island does make it a little trickier. So a little bit limiting for some, but it's great in terms of, you know, certainly had beautiful weather. And
no, once you're
fantastic.
Here, it really is a phenomenal place. At least for this part of the year. I don't think, you know, I'd want to be here in January when it's raining every day. But
yeah, I know, talking to the, you know, it is bit desolate, right? And and you can't go really far, whereas you know, Central Canada, there is a lot of options to be able to drive quite a distance along the corridor. Even the prairies, you can do a lot of driving.
You don't have to pay attention on the prairies, you're not going to hit anything. It's a beautiful thing,
except a moose.
So, and you also edit the bulletin.
I did two issues, and yeah. so that torch is being passed to Robert Talbot.
Okay, but if anyone has ideas for the bulletin, they can...
Any council member you can let know. Everybody's, you know, works to contribute to make it serious, readable. And I think that, you know, something that we're trying to do is, you know, have more updates, more information, and try with the limited resources that we do have to do some modeling that's, you know, the American Historical Association. Mm-hmm. They have a huge staff, right? But right. we still would like to, you know, make updating members a little bit more easy or more often, even if it's just, you know, maybe a monthly update as opposed to three times a year through the bulletin. Mm-hmm. But yeah, more articles, more contributions are always well received.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks so much for doing this.
You're welcome. Thank you for asking.
All right. And there's Joe McCutcheon.
And last but not least, our Congress rookie, Jody Nurse from the University of Guelph. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks for doing this, because it was very easy for me to talk you into doing it.
Yes.
Which was good.
I was very eager.
Yes. It's cool because we actually went to high school together, too.
True story.
And now we're both doing PhDs at different universities, but who would have thought from Georgetown, Ontario? Not I. Especially because I didn't think I'd be doing it. So it's kind of cool. So this is your first time at Congress. Just in general, what are your thoughts? What do you think?
I really think it was a great, great Congress. I thought the CHA program was excellent. But Victoria... It was a beautiful place to have it. Mm. I think we had perfect weather. And just the organization was really excellent. But I was extremely impressed with the panels this year. So
yeah, and because you do environmental rural history. So you were saying that you really enjoyed that part of it. And you thought there were some really good topics, really good papers.
Definitely.
Really applicable to your own work.
Yes, I was really impressed, actually. There's a number of kind of rural-oriented panels that were really, really strong. And what's neat about rural history, you know, you can tie in agricultural, environmental, food, animal. So all of these topics, I think, many of which are quite popular right now, especially. But I think that was reflected in the papers that were presented this year. But the nice thing, too, is, you know, I go to these panels that I you know, think will be applicable to my own work. But I also tried to go to some that maybe you don't see the direct relevance necessarily in the topic matter, because I find that's really interesting. People working on something completely different, but you can really take away whether it's theory, methodology, the way they approach their topic, and apply that to your own work. And I think that's interesting because it helps develop your own field of study.
And for you being the first time here, now this isn't your first conference, first Congress.
Yes.
Was the dynamic here, did you think, was it maybe a little different from other things that you've been at, just because it's the whole social science and humanities folks are all around as opposed to just a specific organization?
Yeah, I think what I like about Congress is that you really can have the chance to see some speakers that perhaps you wouldn't necessarily have the chance to see. And it's certainly a different experience because, let's face it, you know, these are the rock stars of history, right? So you really get to meet people that you've followed their research and you're very impressed with their work, and then actually to have the chance to talk to them. And I think that's why it's so important for graduate students, especially, not only to get your name out there and to have the chance to present, but to take away different people's presentation styles. And to meet some of these key people in your field is extremely motivational and inspirational. So I think all of those reasons are certainly why graduate students such as myself, and I wish I had of, you know, I'm in my third year of my PhD, and I wish I had of made it to earlier conferences, because I really did have an incredible experience here.
For you, there was no sense of being intimidated first time here with all these people who previously you had known from reading their books or reading their articles. There's no sense of, like, that they're unapproachable.
I'm fortunate because I have a fantastic supervisor and a strong relationship with my supervisor. And so it's nice when you have someone that is able to introduce you to these people. And so I was in a fortunate situation that way. But at the same time, I think that for any graduate student, in my experience, everyone was very approachable, and especially to have the chance to be on a panel with some really esteemed scholars, it gives you that opening to discuss topics further. So I think if at all you have a chance when you're a graduate student, not just putting together a panel with your immediate friends and colleagues, but actually reaching out to some of those leading scholars in your field, because you'd be surprised about how willing they are to have you on a panel or to participate on a panel you are organizing. So I think that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and I know it's, for me at least, it's somewhat heartening when some of these scholars come up after the presentation, or even just talking to them in the hall, and they're like, and they seem engaged in what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
And they have questions and interesting questions, and help you re-examine what you're doing. Because for me, the most interesting part of conferences, or the best part of conferences, isn't necessarily the paper itself that you give. It's the feedback that you get and the ways that you can look at it differently and stuff you can change. And to me, it's about making the paper better. And that's why I like to present stuff out of the dissertation, because I feel that it strengthens the dissertation as a whole, being able to look at these things from different perspectives. And that's what you get when you have sort of the top people around, and it's really helpful.
Yeah, and everyone approaches topics differently, and everyone has different insights. So, So you may approach a topic and had not even thought of a certain something that perhaps you're missing, or another approach. And so, having scholars there that can really ask those questions and actually open your mind to some new possibilities for your own topics is crucial. And then, like you said too, it's when you have, you know, a leading scholar come up to you after a panel and say, you know, I really enjoyed that work. I think it's important. I think it's really, it's fun. It's interesting. Yeah. It's whatever. It's extremely motivational. So all of that are reasons why you should, you know, whether it's you feel uncomfortable or very comfortable presenting, it's worth for those getting out of your comfort zone so you actually can participate.
Because, you were saying that for you, it's for as exhausted as you may be right now, you know, it's energizing.
Yes.
You're leaving here energized.
Yes.
About your topic and about what you're doing moving forward. So give the people a thrill. What are you doing moving forward?
So I work at the University of Guelph, and I focus on women's involvement in agriculture and agricultural organizations, but specifically my thesis dissertation is on women in agricultural societies, and so their participation in these organizations, in these associations, but also what they were actually doing at the main event that these groups put on, which was the fairs, the exhibitions. And so my studies, you know, at first it was more, it has kind of everything from political side to it, and their involvement, but also social, cultural, what the things they were showing at fairs represent. I'm finding actually, you know, we tend to think about fairs today being these very traditional, often outdated events, I would say, you know, the doilies that our grandmothers are still making and showing. But it's interesting, if you follow the fair and the changes that were going on, there were these incredible transformations, and they really can be representative of the socio and economic changes going on in the countryside. But that being said, there's also that very much commemorative aspect of fairs and the harking back to the traditional. So it's an interesting balance of these fairs being promoted as progressive and improving, but at the same time holding on to some traditional values and skills and abilities. So.
And part of what you're doing at Guelph, you said these rural roundtables.
Yes, yeah. So Catherine Ann Wilson is the coordinator of the rural history roundtables, and I'm a co-coordinator. And so one of our goals at Guelph really has a truly excellent faculty and of Canadianness and, you know, Scottish studies they're known for. But especially, you know, rural studies is something that we're trying to develop as well. And we have rural roundtables. We had a symposium actually last fall that went over really well. We had historians, you know, cultural, environmental, agricultural, rural historians there. And we hope in the future to have another conference coming up. I won't give away any details yet because it's in the works, but we do have speakers, so we try to invite different speakers on rural topics. Mm-hmm. And so that's something, if anyone listening is interested in presenting work related to rural history in whatever fashion, they should contact Kathy or myself, because we really are looking for up-and-coming scholars, you know, everything from graduate students to professors to even industry professionals mm-hmm. have presented some work. So it's cool. It's been an interesting experience for me as well.
Very nice. And just being in Victoria, just in general, just to wrap up, you actually went out and saw the city a little bit.
Yes.
You weren't just sort of centralized on campus.
Yes.
Good choice. I've asked everybody this.
Yes.
You like the choice of city? Because there was some discussion of maybe it's too far afield for a lot of folks, but I mean, now that we're here.
Yeah, I actually, I presented on the last panel of the last
yes.
day. So I actually had to, wait a little longer to breathe that sigh of relief, I think. But that being said, I was able to get out and do some tours of Victoria, and it's really beautiful. And actually, I had heard that when I first arrived, you know, some of the logistics would be an issue, but I think that everything on the campus was so easy, and staying on the campus was just an excellent choice to get around to the different panels. Mm-hmm. But the help, the organization, transit was extremely easy to get downtown and back again. So I think it wasn't too far. I think it actually worked out really well, and everyone I've talked to really got a chance to go out and see the surrounding area too.
Yeah,
so.
For sure. And for me, the concern was mostly just the flying. And the,
I see.
Because I don't like to fly. And that's like, I flew out here Sunday night, and it was a bad idea to book a night flight because all day Sunday it was just a waste for me. I couldn't sit still. I was so nervous.
You should have, instead of going on the train back, you should have come on the train here too and then took the ferry, and then you would have been fine.
I know. But I figured I couldn't spend 8 days on the train. So I could spend 4 going one way, but 8 total might have been a little much. So, and I figure if I had to fly one way, I might as well fly out. I just should have had a morning flight, because then I'm not sitting around thinking about it.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, so that was my big concern, and I think...
You're sounding very Ontario right now, Sean.
Why?
that you had to travel so far.
I had to travel, yes.
You're not...
I would have had the same feeling if I had to travel to, Newfoundland, anywhere I had to fly.
Okay.
I would have had... The concern would have been the same.
So really,
all
conferences should be held
within
Canada.
Driving distance for me.
I see.
Yeah, and then I won't be so crazy when I have to get on the plane. The thing is, it's like once I get on the plane, I'm fine.
Okay.
It's just getting me on the plane is the process.
Right. I think you should protest to the organizing committee, though.
Yes, because I'm such a major player.
Yeah.
They'll listen to me, of course. So thanks so much for doing this, Jody.
Oh, no, thanks. Even though I was hesitant, I really enjoy talking to you, Sean, so thanks for having me.
Pleasure's all mine.
So there you have it, 3 different perspectives on Congress 2013 from Victoria. I really think it was a successful Congress, and I really had a lot of fun. And for as much as it may seem like I was complaining about having to go to Victoria, it really was a terrific opportunity, and the weather was beautiful. Yeah, I've been out here for, I think, 5 days now, and I've seen 3 drops of rain. It's been sunny, it's been delightful, and many congratulations go to Penny Bryden and the entire organizing committee in Victoria. My thanks to Daniel Ross, Joe McCutcheon, and Jody Nurse. If you have any questions, comments for the podcast, historyslam@gmail.com, Twitter @DrShawneeFever, and as always, if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Check out activehistory.ca for more features and articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.